Welcome to our Lakeline Campus Phil Country Bible Church. And for those of you who are coming to us from Steiner, we're so glad you're here worshiping with us. We're in a sermon series called Exchange. And we're actually asking ourselves the question, how would I ever change if I'm not willing to exchange? In other words, rather than just an additive approach to life, what are the things that are holding me back that need to be subtracted? And we're headed toward a 21-day exchange. So next Sunday when you get here, we're going to be challenging you to take the 21-day challenge, the exchange challenge, where you actually identify some things that for 21 days you're going to say no to. You're going to stop to open up your life for God, to do some things that may be out of the ordinary in your life. And we've been looking at a lot of different things that could be there. For example, we looked at exchanging truth for lies. There's some lies that we've heard all of our lives that we keep telling ourselves, and those lies are actually holding us back. So what's the truth? We also, last week, looked at the issue of consumption. We live in a consumer culture where we're constantly feeding ourselves in various ways. Is that masking the deeper hunger that can never really be satisfied until we stop consuming and let that hunger drive us into deeper relationship with God and other people? This week, we're going to talk about exchanging busyness for margin. And we're going to talk about the fast pace of our lives and what it actually does to us and what God's intent is for us. And then next week, we're going to talk about information. We live in a world where we're inundated with information, but we lack inspiration. Is there a way to set aside some of our technology and some of our habits to open up more opportunity for inspiration? So that's where we're going. And today we're talking about busyness and margins. A number of years ago, Dr. Swenson started to notice that he had many patients in his office with maladies that weren't caused by germs or genetics. He started to notice a pattern in many sick people that it was actually stress that was killing their health. The more he paid attention to that, he started realizing that it was killing marriages, that more people were becoming depressed, the suicide rate was going up, that people in the most affluent nation on the planet were actually experiencing less and less and less of life. And so he wrote a book, which has been reprinted a number of times, Dr. Swenson's book, the book Margin, talking about putting space back into your life in order to reduce stress. Let me give you his definition of margin. His definition of margin is this: margin is the space that once existed. Notice that. He says once existed, it's gone. We've given it up. The space that once existed between ourselves and our limits, kind of a dirty word in culture today, right? We're limitless. We can do all things. The space between ourselves and our limits, it's something held in reserve for contingencies or unanticipated situations. Let me show you what this looks like practically in real life using some dominoes here. So if these dominoes represent your life, you may be thinking, well, as I think about my life, I've really got to start working on personal improvement, personal development. So I need to make sure that I eat right. That's important. I need to make sure I get to the gym, get some exercise in. I really need to improve my mind, maybe some reading. Maybe I would take an online course from time to time. I probably ought to really work on my relationships with other people, so I'm working on me. But I'm not just working on me. I've got other issues. I got work. And so I got to make sure that I'm going in early, I'm doing the best job I can, that I'm looking for promotions and opportunities to advance, that I'm willing to take on new projects, maybe travel if that's necessary, and that I'm always looking for a way to get the boss's attention so they'll see all that I'm doing so the rest of my lousy coworkers don't steal all the credit for everything I do. But that's not just all my life. I've got financial issues I've got to deal with. I got to have a roof over my head. I got to have a car, and I really need to have a good car. I got to maintain the technology in my life. If I've got kids or a spouse, I need to make sure that they've got everything they want. I need to take some good vacations and make sure I've got enough money to take good vacations. And oh, speaking of the kids, well, you know, my kids may be athletic, so I got to get them to select sports, but I don't want to neglect their minds, so AP courses at school. I also need to make sure, like, if they have other gifts, they may be musical, and I want to make sure that I don't miss the next Jimi Hendrix. In addition to that, I need to just kind of keep up with all the stuff that they've got going on with their friends and their social life, and then I need to have a quiet time. And you know that when we preach and say, y'all ought to have a quiet time, what you hear is, yeah, that's a good idea. So what do you feel when you're looking at a stand of dominoes that are standing up? There's a little tenseness. Like if I bump this table right now, what's going to happen? They're going to go, right? You feel that tenseness? That's the same feeling that you have when you have no margin in your life. When every single brain cell is occupied trying to pay attention to what you're doing so you don't let anything slip through the cracks. Every nickel in your bank account is accounted for, and most of it in your current income is accounted for before you ever even receive your check. That every aspect of your time is thought through and scheduled out. And all that it takes is for one of those things to go south, and your life tends to go south, not to mention, what if we have a medical problem? What if the economy turns down? What if I lose my job? What if one of my kids has an emotional problem? And if one of those things happen, there goes my life. Like everything falls apart. Now, here's what's really interesting. Actually, people that experience this find out it really wasn't that bad. In fact, some of you guys have been through this before and you went, wow, that's the best thing that ever happened to me. All of a sudden, I found out I'm not going to die if I don't do all these things. But it is the fear that we live with in the presence of the stress of no margin in our lives that drives us. And so maybe a better way to do this is to say, okay, I really do need to eat right and get some exercise. You know, maybe from time to time I need to read a book and maybe I need to take an online class. I need to do some of those things, but, you know, I am not going to have rock hard abs. I'm just not going to have buns of steel. I can't do that and keep up with my life. I've got to leave something off the table that I'm not going to do. And so when it comes to my work, sure, I'm going to put in the hours necessary to do a good job. I'm going to look at ways to improve myself. I may travel occasionally if that comes up. But when it comes to really just trying to find the way to make the most money, there are going to be times when I just say, you know, I can't do that. I mean, I could, but I'm going to leave something off the table. When it comes to my finances, okay, there's a reasonableness to the way I spend my money. I'm not going to have to live in a house that costs me more than I can afford or drive a car. I may have technology, but it may not be a 5. Maybe a 4S. Who knows? And so that dream vacation that I've got to take right now while I'm 22 and still healthy, maybe I can put that off until I'm 42 and decrepit. You know, maybe they'll have handicapped access. Leaving some space. And then when it comes to kids, okay, you know, maybe I do have a kid that's exceptionally gifted in athletics, but let's face it, he's not very smart, so we're not going to worry that much about that. And we're not going to add in all of the various things that go along with that, but we do want to have them to have friends and so forth, and maybe I'll have a quiet time. So what margin is? Margin is the space that exists between what I could do and what I choose to do, recognizing that I have limits in my life. And so if something tips over, let's try this and see if it works. If something tips over, I'm still half here. Does that make sense? You see what margins are? We get the concept of margins because every time you pick up a book to read it, what does it have around the black print? It has a margin. You know what? Our government has paid for research that's demonstrated by, well, you need to know this because it's your tax dollars work. Research that's demonstrated that books that have smaller print and smaller margins are read faster and comprehended less than books that have larger print and larger margins. Why? You know why. Because when you look at the page and all that data on it, you start thinking, man, I'm never going to get through this. And you start reading really fast. And your goal becomes to get it done, not to get anything out of it. And that's the way most of us are living our lives. We get our lives so full of stuff that all we have time to do is get it done, not to get anything out of it. And it diminishes us. And it does something more than that. Driving down 35, when you come to those stretches where it's 3 lanes wide with a shoulder on each side, you have time to put your arm up on the rest, listen to the radio, talk to somebody, drive along, think about the beauty around you, well, what little there is, you know, and you know, it's all good, right? It's relaxing. And then you come to those stretches where they're doing road construction, and there is no shoulder on the road. In fact, what they have on the road are these 6 feet concrete barriers on each side of the road. And here's what you know. You know that if I veer 12 inches to the right, I'm crashing into concrete, and if I veer 12 inches to the left, I'm going to be running into an 18-wheeler. So what does that do about the way you drive? Your hands both go on the steering wheel. You lean forward. Your shoulders tense up. Your wife is talking to you, and you're not listening to her anymore. You're not listening to the radio. You're not thinking about what you're going to do. You are focused. Here's the problem with a life that lacks margin. Three things happen to us. The first one is we get stressed out. When everything is accounted for, every minute, every dollar, every amount of our energy and our gifting is accounted for. When that begins to happen, we get stressed out. We are maxed out. We are overloaded. We talk about people being burned out because there's such a prolonged period of this. We stress out. The second thing it does is we become self-absorbed. Think about it. When you're driving in that situation down 35 and you're shushing the person next to you so you can focus, it's not because you hate the person next to you. It's because you have to pay attention to what you're doing because it's dangerous to stop paying attention. And when we have no margin in our life, we feel the same way. It's dangerous to stop paying attention to what I have to do to get my work done. And if I quit paying attention to that, then things are going to fall through the cracks. And so I find myself walking past people, not even realizing they're there, not because I don't care about them, but because I don't see them at all. I don't see them at all. Finally, we become relationship poor. We become relationship poor. Relationships blossom in margin. Busyness is the enemy of intimacy. It's the enemy of intimacy. Think about it this way. Why is it that a preoccupied, cranky dad turns into a patient, caring granddad? You ever notice that? The old man's down on the floor rolling around with your kids, making all kinds of weird goo-goo gaga sounds, and you think, where was he when I was growing up? Like, all I heard was chores, get your homework done, take care of things, move along. Well, what happened? Well, he became a grandfather. He didn't have to manage you. And so now he's relaxed. He's stress-free. He's got margin in his life. Are they two different people? I've heard people say that. Like, my father is a different man than he was when I was growing up. Maybe he wasn't a different man. Maybe he was a stressed man. And how many marriages are on the rocks because both people are not themselves under stress? I hear people say to me all the time, you know, the things that attracted me to him or the things that attracted me to her are the things that are driving me away. Well, those positive characteristics, when you pour on self-absorption, stress, and all those, what that becomes is become something that's less than beautiful, less than good. It becomes ugly sometimes. And so the person that you married maybe was the person who actually took the time to care about you. And that poem that they composed, or that love song that they spent time writing and thinking about you, now becomes an angry text message. Here's the answer to your question. And you know, by the tone of the text message, you can feel it in your fingers. Leave me alone. I've got too much to do. And you go, well, what happened to that guy? What happened to that woman? I'm convinced there are people sitting in this room that are now divorced today, and their marriage broke up over this issue of not having margin. You thought it was her, or you thought it was him. And really what it was making and building a lifestyle that did not continue to foster the love, the feelings, and the intimacy that were there when you stood at the altar, looked each other in the eye, and said, I know with all my heart that I will love you as long as I live. You say, Tim, can stress change us that much? I think it can, over a long period of time. Lack of margins. Now, I want to take some time today to actually show you in the Bible that God designed life to be very different than the way most of us live today. And you'll be surprised where we go, because I'm going to take you to the very first words recorded in the Bible. So if you grab your Bible, turn to Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1, we're going to start with the first verse of the Bible. We're going to start with the first verse of the Bible. Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1, we see the whole thing getting started. And it reads this way: in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Verse 2, now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the water. In other words, the world needed some work. It was formless. It didn't have shape. It was empty. There was no life in it. The world needed some work. And so God started working. Look at what it says in verse 3. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. God saw that the light was good. And he separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day. And the darkness he called night. And there was evening. And there was morning the first day. Now, I know a lot of times people spend their time in Genesis trying to use this as kind of a science text. What I want us to see is the theology that God has been trying to communicate to us and his people for a long time. God worked, and then he stopped because there was evening and there was morning one day. In other words, God was satisfied to do what he was going to do in that 24-hour period, and at the end of that period, he stopped. Now, the next day, he's going to start again doing something else. Here's the principle. The principle is clearly taught through Scripture, that God designed the world with limits. And I think he did that so that we could relax, not be stressed out. There are 24 hours in a day. There are 7 days in a week. There are 365 days in a year. No matter how hard you try, you can't do everything. And God didn't do everything. He did it sequentially. Now, I want you to turn to chapter 2, because this is really cool. As we look at chapter 2, kind of wrapping up the creation, it says in chapter 2, verse 1, thus the heavens and the earth were completed in their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all of his work. Now watch this. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on the seventh, because he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. So God himself, in his own rhythm, decreed that every week, 1/7 of that week would be margin. It would be margin. Like, he built that right in. That 1/7 of every week would be margin. That there would be time set aside. Why would God do that? Did God do that because he was personally tired? Absolutely not. He did that as a pattern to teach us that there's only so much we can do. And then when we get that done, it's time to relax. Now, I want to show you one more passage in relationship to how God has designed the world. So if you turn to the Psalms, Psalm 39, about the middle of the Old Testament, if you'll turn to Psalm 39, I want you to see how that relates to us personally. God decreed limits so we can relax. Those limits are not just in the physical world. Those limits are also in our personal lives. Look at verse 4, David speaking. He says, show me, O Lord, my life's end. Now, most of us would say, God, I don't want to know when I'm going to go. Like, let that sneak up on me. Why? Why do we not want to know that? The reason why we don't want to know that is because we don't want to start thinking that this is going to get over. That's kind of a weird thought. We kind of want to believe that we are unlimited in our opportunity, in our time. We don't like to think in terms of limits, but the psalmist is saying, if you don't recognize your limits, you're never going to be wise. Look at what he says. Show me, O Lord, my life's end, the number of my days. Let me know how fleeting my life is. I need to know how limited I really am. You have made my days a mere handbreadth. So if you'll touch your thumb, take your hand and spread it out like this, from your thumb to the end of your little finger, that's a handbreadth. This is how big my life is in light of eternity. Can this span of life do everything out there available to me? No way. So relax. The span of my years is as nothing before you, but each man's life is but a breath. So take a breath. In light of eternity, that's how short your life is. It's very limited. Man is a mere phantom as he goes to and fro. He bustles about, but only in vain. He heaps up wealth, not knowing who will get it. I love this verse, verse 6. Man is a mere phantom. He bustles about to and fro. So think about the angels looking down on your life and your day. So since they've looked down on your life and everybody else's life, and they've seen everybody that came before you and the people that came before them and the people that came before them, here is the image. It's almost as if when you're looking down, our life is like a phantom. You know that shadow that moves across the screen when they put things in fast motion, and you just see the image of the person moving, and then you see the image of the person moving, and you see the image of the person moving, and then they're out of the room? And what remains? The room. And that's what David is saying. I'm like this phantom that just comes on the planet and I scurry around doing all the stuff that I'm doing, working hard, making my money, acquiring my wealth. And it's kind of like I just float around here and then I'm gone. And everything I've worked on, everything I've built, everything I've done, it's still there. The earth doesn't change, it's still there. The only thing that happened was a lot of activity and then gone. So if my life consists of a lot of activity and then gone, then what else should I put my focus into? He says in verse 7, but now, Lord, what do I look for? My hope is in you. My hope is not in my calendar. My hope is not in my bank account. My hope is not in my education. My hope is not in what I can experience. My hope is not in the love of my life. My hope is actually in you when I recognize that there are limits to life. You designed it that way. I only get to live for a little while. And so I can begin to relax and do the most important things and do those things only. Why don't we do this? I think there are two reasons. I think we as people are driven by a fear. We have this fear that we're going to miss out on something. We have a fear that we're going to miss out on something. It's really a fear of falling behind. Like everybody else is off, making progress, doing things, and if I'm not running along with them, I'm falling further and further and further behind. There are people right now that are running a marathon today. And they're going to, some of them are going to complete it in a really short period of time, and the rest of them are going to run all day long. And sometimes we feel that way, like we're running all the way along, and the winners are way up there. And so we do really interesting things. And we want to make sure we get our four-year-old in T-ball, because if they can't hit the ball off the tee, they'll never be able to hit coach pitch. And if they can't hit coach pitch, they can't hit kid pitch. And if they can't hit kid pitch, they'll never be on a select team. And if they never get on a select team, they'll never make it into the major leagues. And if they don't make it into the major leagues, then they probably won't have any friends in school. And if they don't have any friends in school, they'll probably drop out and do drugs and make your life miserable. And so I'm looking at my four-year-old thinking, whoa, we better get this kid into T-ball. Or Harvard. Man, we've got to get them reading when they're two. Because who knows, we may have the next genius on our hands. And it would be okay if that's all we did. We picked something that fit our child and worked with them. But we want everything for every one of our kids and the same thing for ourselves. And we're afraid of falling behind. The second big fear that we have, it's actually more of guilt than fear, is this guilt of underperforming. The skill of underperforming, to think, we've been told all our lives, we are humans and humans have unlimited potential. And so with your unlimited potential, you ought to be able to do everything. You ought to be able to run the United Nations. You ought to be able to run Apple Computer. You ought to be able to run a Major League Baseball. You ought to be able to run the music. Like, you ought to be able to do everything. And by the way, walk on the moon and stuff like that too. Like, we ought to be able to do all these things. And so what happens if we don't? When I was in college, back in the 50s, the 1950s, for you who've forgotten 19, it wasn't quite that long ago, but I was a sophomore in college, and I had a Encyclopedia Britannica salesman knock on my dorm room door, and he was selling a set of Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, for those of you who don't know what Encyclopedia Britannica is, Encyclopedia Britannica was the internet that your parents used. All of the information that could be stored on the planet was stored in this set of books, and it was perfect. Whenever you were going to do a research project in high school or college, you'd open it up and you'd find your topic and you'd read a couple pages, and that would get you launched on where to go to find your research project, kind of like Wikipedia, only bound up in paper, trees cut down and stuff like that to be able to do this. And so, man, I'm looking at those things and I'm thinking, I would be by far the coolest kid in the dorms if I had these. That shows you how backwards people were back in the 50s. And so I bought the thing, and I had them up on my shelf in my dorm room. People that got locked out of the library back when they used to close the library after midnight, they would come to my room. They would be doing their research there. It was so cool. But the other thing the guy had, and he kind of pitched it to me second. So as long as you're buying these Encyclopedia Britannicas for a few hundred bucks more, and by the way, I paid for them out of my own money, cost about the same amount of money as it cost for me to go to college that year, which wasn't that much, but it was a lot. If you know what I mean. So anyway, he's got this other set of books called The Great Books of the Western World. 54 volumes. This represented all the great thinkers of the Western world, starting all the way back with Homer, going all the way up to William James. 54 volumes of their original work. And I thought, I have got to have this, because how could I be a legitimate intellectual human being and live on a planet if I didn't read the original writings of the main thinkers that shaped our world? In other words, how could I balance my checkbook if I had never read Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations? How could I do that? I mean, how could I know anything about science if I didn't read Faraday and Newton and Darwin? How could I know anything about love if I didn't read all of Shakespeare's complete works? How could I know anything about God if I didn't read Milton? Like, how could I know these things? How could I actually be human? And so I bought all those books, and a couple years ago, we were boxing up some books and giving away some stuff, and Cindy said to me, "You think it's time to get rid of these?" And I said, "Oh, no." Because one of these days, I'm going to read every single one of those books, all 54 volumes. What's that? What is that? So this week we had the privilege, Cindy and I had the privilege of sitting down with all of the pastors in our association and their wives, and all the churches that we planted, and all of the pastors, and just having a conversation about life and ministry and what that looks like. One of the topics we were talking about is how do we work smart and work hard and do that in a way that balances life. And I can tell you there have been many times in my life when I did not do either of those things. But I did tell the pastors this. A lot of these young guys just getting started, I told them this. I said, when Cindy and I got married and started having kids, I made a commitment to her that I was going to do no blogs, no books, and very limited outside speaking engagements. I'm not going to spend my time writing my ideas down for a very limited audience to read. I am not going to spend my time writing books. I'm not going to be traveling around the country speaking. And I've had challenges and encouragements to do all of those. In fact, many of the people that are peers of mine who have pursued that have huge public names now. Like, they're very big people. But God didn't call me to be a big person. God called me to be a balanced person, to shepherd the flock and lead them, not go out and develop a name for myself. And I can tell you, honoring that has made a huge difference in the temptations that I would have had to give my time away in other places than my kids and my wife and this church and my friendships. At some point in time, you have to say, you know what? If limiting my life to what I can do within reason is being a loser, then I'm going to be a loser for God. Because if I don't, I will be a loser for myself and my family and the people around me. Why do we do this? Here's the question I ask. At what point in time will you exercise your personal free will that's been given to you as a gift by God to tell all the voices that are shouting in your head that you need to jam your life full of activities, you need to spend every last dollar, you need to be discontent with your life until you've stretched it to the limit? When are you going to say, shut up? The expectations of the culture around me will not dictate to me what I'm going to do with my time and my relationships and my money. I will say no to those things so that I can say yes to the Creator who created me. See, God designed you with limits. You can't do everything, so don't do it. Relax. The second truth that comes out of this passage, I think, is really profound. It really flows out of Genesis chapter 2. As we look at it together, is that God actually designed rhythms. He designed rhythms into our world to create margin. He designed a rhythm into the week. 6 days, work. Seventh day, take the whole day off. If that isn't just right out front telling us we need this, I don't know what it is. In fact, he came back in the fourth commandment in Exodus chapter 20 and told the nation of Israel, this is one of the big ten. Now let me ask you, how many days can a human being go, putting their nose to the grindstone, taking care of the responsibilities of life, working hard at it, before they need a break to stop and look up at the one who created everything and say, am I on the right track? Am I even doing what I'm supposed to be doing? Are you working in me? What are you doing? What do you want me to do? How many days can you do that? How many days can a human being go? According to God, it's six. Six is all you get. Like, if you don't stop and check in with God in a significant way every seventh day, and when I say significant, he set aside the whole day, like 24 hours. If you don't stop every 6 days and take one full day, that seventh day, to really stop and go, wait. Like, if you don't do that, you're not going to be connected to what God has for your life. And let me just suggest that getting in a car with your family in tow, driving to a location, getting out and walking in with a group of people with one and only one purpose, and that is to collectively meet with God, to open up the emotions of your heart, to reconnect with Jesus Christ as you sing and speak worship to him and pray to him, to listen to his word taught so that it's something you can take with you and discuss it, to spend time in prayer and meditation. So it involves your physical, because you're a physical person. It involves your emotional. It involves your spiritual. It connects with your intellect. That idea of corporate worship is becoming so optional in our world today. So very optional. Now, I'm speaking to you guys. You guys are here, so I guess I'm speaking to the choir, right? Like, you guys get this. But there's so many people that don't get this. And taking time out once a month to connect with God's people and God's worship is becoming common. Or twice a month, it's becoming common. And so what we're doing is we're stringing together days and days and days when we actually don't carve out time to stop and pay attention to God. Hey, this idea of corporate worship, us getting together to worship God, I want to let you know a little secret. This was not my idea. There wasn't a pastor one day that said, hey, we can really make people have a difficult time getting their schedule worked out if we could just take a big chunk of time and make them come and worship God. This is actually God's idea. It's actually God's idea. One really important note to parents. If you teach your kids that their activities are more important than taking time out on a weekly basis to worship God, you just watch when they get to college what they do with their activities. You just watch. I mean, we've raised a whole generation of kids that are dropping out as soon as they leave our house. But we planted those seeds long before that. And I get how hard that is. I raised four kids. Sometimes I'm glad. Sometimes I look at them and go, whoa, what did I do wrong here? I know that. I mean, that's just reality. But one of the things we did, Ellen was our big sports person, and she played volleyball all over the United States and a scholarship to college. One of the commitments we made is, Ellen, you are not going to go on a weekend tournament unless you're going to commit to being worship on Sunday. And so she found a church in Austin that she could do Sunday night at. So when she got in on the plane on Sunday afternoon, regardless of homework or whatever, if she wanted to go on that trip, she was going to be in worship. And the reason why we did that is because her volleyball is not more important than connecting with God. She's not. She's done with volleyball. She's done. She finished. She's done. 4 years. It's over. Now what's she going to do? She's got a relationship with God, right? Another really cool thing as we wrap up here. I want you to see back in Genesis chapter 1, this is really interesting to me. This was kind of mind-blowing to me this week. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 5, the last sentence in the verse, it says, and there was evening and there was morning the first day. Notice when the day starts in God's rhythm. The day begins in the evening and then continues to the morning. In other words, God set this up so that we would begin to understand that the day begins when we are winding down, when it's getting dark, when we are going to sleep. That doesn't mean God quit working. In fact, God is already working. He's working through the night. While you're sleeping, God is actually at work. For the farmer who lays his head on his pillow at night knows that as the night goes on, God is germinating the seeds. He's causing the cells to divide. The plant is beginning to grow. The rains are falling. The cattle are growing up. They're producing milk. And when the farmer gets up in the morning, he doesn't get up to start doing something that is laid dormant. That's a human concept. He begins the day by joining God in the work that God has already started. We begin the day knowing God's been working in my office, in the hearts of the people, in the thinking all night long. I'm showing up now to join him in what he is already doing. And that rhythm of waking up and saying, okay, God, how do I fit in? What do you want me to do? It takes the pressure off those people who believe that at 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock when your alarm goes off, it's up to you to make it, and you've got to grind it out as hard as you can for the rest of the day. Because when that day's over, if you didn't do it, it didn't happen. The reality is, God's always working, and he's already working. So our challenge today is this. Will we begin to live with rhythms that God has set in motion? I've got limits on my life. I can't do it all. So let me just pick the things I need to do. I'm called to do what God's called me to do, and let the rest go. And that's going to be different for each one of us in here. We're all unique. We've been designed different. We have different callings. My question is, when are we going to stop living everybody else's calling and just be really good at the one that God's called us to and have a lot of fun and relax along the way? When are we going to do that? When are we going to live within our means so that we sit in our old house and we look around and say, God, thank you for this house. Not just keep driving up and down the street looking at all those other ones that are going to be old 2 years after you buy it. When are we going to start doing that? And then God's designed time in. Are you building time in to each day, to your weekend, to stop and let relationships happen, let deep thoughts happen? And for those of you who are saying, hey, Tim, I don't have a problem with this. Like, I come home in the evening, I don't have a whole lot to do. I got 3 or 4 hours worth of TV I can watch every night. That's next week's sermon. Talk about that next week, okay? Let's bow our heads. Father in heaven, my prayer for each person in here is that you would open their eyes to places where they've tightened things down so tight, time, relationships, work, money, that they just need to let some of that go to build in some margin so they can begin to experience all that you intend for them in life. Father, may you speak, not my words, your words, may you speak very specifically into this group this week. And as we gather next week to make commitments to start this 21-day exchange, may people come having heard from you. For we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. I'm going to invite